This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
A growing number of people in Britain today are classified as economically inactive. And this is increasingly talked about as a major problem, which is seriously inhibiting economic growth, as well as being very expensive. So what do we know about who these people are? Why they're in the position that they are? How big a problem is it really for the country? And what do we do about it? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. Joining me are Tony Wilson, who's Director of the Institute for Employment Studies, Sam Evanto-Windett, who's Deputy Director at the Learning and Work Institute, and Torsten Bell, Chief Executive at the Resolution Foundation and author of Great Britain, How We Get Our Future Back. Torsten Bell, can we start by defining what we mean by economically inactive?
Yeah, so we don't mean people are entirely inactive. We mean they are neither doing paid work or looking currently for paid work. That's the definition in the labour force statistics.
So just that.
That's all we mean.
Right. Tony Wilson, at the latest count, how many people in the UK were economically inactive?
Well, so at the latest count, people aged 16 to 64, we've got about 9.4 million people are economically inactive. And that's, so it's just over a fifth of everybody who's aged between 16 and 64 are outside the labour force.
Right. And these people, Torsten, they don't fall into the unemployment statistics.
Well, none of them are unemployed in the sense that to be economically inactive, they have to, when they're asked in the survey, they have to say, I am not looking for work. And as soon as you say that, you cannot be unemployed, because unemployed means you would like a job, you're available to take a job. So these are different groups. And I think that is really important to have in our heads. So traditionally, people would have worried about high unemployment. That's what we worried about after the financial crisis. That's what we worried about all the way through the 1980s and 1990s, because we had high unemployment rates and we had high youth unemployment rates after the financial crisis.
And high long-term unemployment.
Exactly. Rates. Today, we don't have those problems. We have almost record low levels of unemployment. And so we need something else to worry about. What is filling that role? Economic inactivity.
OK. Tony Wilson, what are the main components of economically inactive people and the rough proportions that they fall into?
Yeah, so there's about four or five different reasons, main reasons that are given for being economically inactive. So at the moment, the most common reason is having a long-term health condition or a disability, which means that you can't look for work, or you're not available for work. There's around 2.8 million people say that the main reason they're not looking for work is that they've got a long-term health condition. The other sort of very common reason is that people are students or studying. Now, of course, if you're studying, you could also be working or you could also be unemployed. But so students who aren't looking for work, it's about 2.6 million of those. So those two combined are well over half of all economic inactivity. And then the other reasons, you could be looking after a family at home. I mean, this is where the definitions are most sort of daft, really, because you're not economically inactive if you're raising a young family, for example, or you're not inactive, at least, you know, you'd be very active, but you're just not in the labour force. That number's been sort of coming down and down because we're having families later, because we're having smaller families, we're spending more time in work around having kids. But it's about 1.6 million people in that category. And then beyond that, we're down into sort of smaller numbers, which can include early retirement. Waiting for a job to start can be quite a common reason. Not feeling that you need to work, or feeling that you've been discouraged from work, that you're beyond being unemployed, if you like. You know, you've simply stopped looking. And combined, you've got about 2 million people in those different categories there.
Sam Evanto-Windett, are there certain parts of the country where the problem is more acute than others?
Yeah, we do find that there's big variation across the country in the proportion of people who are aged 16 and over who are economically inactive due to long-term sickness, this problem that we're focusing on. You can see sort of stark contrast. For example, one in 100 people are economically inactive due to long-term sickness in parts of Surrey. Compare that to 1 in 7 people in parts of Merseyside. So as with many of these sort of labour market issues, the issue is quite localised. Before the statistics sort of became a little bit more difficult to interpret from September, you could see changes on a regional level. So we saw a bigger rise in London in economic inactivity, and we saw actually a decrease in the West Midlands. But whilst it's useful to look at regional levels, it is really the local level where you see most difference.
I hesitate to ask, but why did they become more difficult after September?
So actually the number of people responding to the Labour Force survey dropped, and the actual weight that you can give to the numbers became more challenging. So since September, they are trying to rectify it, and there will hopefully be more certainty later this year in those stats.
I think I'm happy to go on stats up until September. That's still comparatively recent. So what that's geographically. What can we say about, say, gender and class divides?
Yeah, so we've looked at the class and gender divides in our analysis, and we've actually seen quite a difference in why people have been leaving the labour market. People in those lower paying occupations are more likely to leave for health reasons, and those in the higher paying occupations more likely to take early retirement. And actually, there's a gender difference. It's a male dominated roles, sort of managers, directors, IT professionals are the ones who took early retirement in the statistics. And those lower paid, traditionally more female dominated roles have been giving up work for health reasons. So that's sort of caring, elementary services, those sorts of roles.
And what about age?
We see quite a tale of two age groups in the data across the working age. So we see amongst young people, more those 18 to 24 year olds rather than 16 to 18. So the 18 to 24 year olds, we've seen a rise in the number of young people not in employment or education. And at the other end of the spectrum, we've seen a massive drop in the number of over 50s who are in the labour market since the pandemic. So the actual figure is 966,000 fewer over 50s. And that number of people who are aged 50 to 64 who are economically inactive has increased by 9.7% since the pandemic.
Right. Well, that puts a percentage on it. And I was going to ask you, Tony Wilson, we've heard 9.4 million people are economically inactive, but what is that as a proportion of 16 to 64-year-olds in the population overall?
Yeah, so it's just over a fifth of all people aged 16 to 64, so it's 22%. And it's worth saying economic inactivity has gone up quite a bit, actually, since the pandemic. But it had been coming down for quite a long time before the pandemic. So we're back up basically to where we were in 2015. But the UK is still a pretty, you know, we are a high employment country. The employment rate's close to 75%. Economic inactivity is lower in the UK than some other countries. The challenge we've got is that it's been rising recently, but also it's that the labour force has stopped growing. It's the other end of it as well. It's that employment is broadly flat and labour force growth is slowing down. Population changes mean we're getting older and so on. So economic inactivity, it's not actually a kind of a massively large number, a massively high figure compared to other countries or historically. It's just it's going in the wrong direction at a time when employment isn't really growing at all.
So if I was to compare it with 20 years ago or standing by in 20 years ago's shoes, I'd say, well, there's not much to be seen here. Move on.
No. And the point is, it's that change in the composition of economic inactivity that's important. You know, really significant falls in the number of people, women, who are outside the labour force for caring reasons, you know, because they're looking after family or a home. You know, that used to be the most common reason for being inactive, being economically inactive, I should say, full stop. It used to be about 2.5 million people. In fact, it used to be even higher than that. And so it's the fact that this has been falling while ill health has been rising and the population is getting older means that combined, it's a set of inactivity has become a kind of a symbol of a set of broader issues about how our population is changing, how work is changing, and how we probably don't have the size of the labour force or the type of labour force that we've previously had or that we might need for the future.
Okay. How does economic inactivity, as we understand it, compare with Germany, France, etc.?
It's lower in the UK than it is in France. It's similar, actually. I think it would probably be slightly higher now than Germany. So the UK has gone from having one of the highest employment rates in the developed world before the pandemic to now being still in the top half, but we're no longer in the top sort of half a dozen, I suppose. So Germany, I believe in the latest data, I think Germany's overtaken or certainly close to us on employment rates overall. But we're much higher than France, higher than Italy, higher than many other countries, much higher than the United States as well.
Yeah,
absolutely. Oh, no, absolutely. Much higher than the United States.
If you were doing this program in the US at the moment, you would be hilariously doing a whole program about how great the jobs boom was. And here we're doing how bad the jobs death is, but UK employment is far higher than in the United States.
Yeah.
Okay, in that case, Sam, I'm bound to ask you, why exactly is this a big problem for the country? Is it a problem of the labour market being too restricted, us not having the workers available? Or is it a problem of the amount of money that we're paying out to people who are economically inactive and that's a strain on the budget?
Yeah, so at risk of saying it is a problem and highlighting that actually to meet the labour force shortages over the coming decades and think about our future skills needs and our future labour market, we do need to help more people into the labour market, in particular those with health conditions and caring responsibilities. It is a growing bill of government that we need to address. There are 1.7 million economically inactive people who say they want to work and actually want to be part of the labour market that we're currently not supporting to be in work. So actually, when you think about it from an individual sort of, you know, local economic communities and also a government problem, it is an issue for all of those. And I think, you know, in my previous answer around the different age groups where we're seeing issues for young people and for those older people and a rise in sort of older age poverty, you know, it's like the analyst who puts their feet in the fridge and their head in the oven and says, overall, we're OK. It's actually not. And it's not for certain groups in the economy.
OK. We've looked at the numbers broadly, and we know who it is we're talking about, but we haven't yet got a handle on why they are economically inactive in the particular ways they are. Well, I think in the case of students, that may be fairly obvious, but in some of the other cases, it's not. And particularly, Sam, we've established that the ill health component is a significant proportion and has been growing. What do we know about why that has happened?
Yeah, so taking that sort of record high of the number of people who are economically inactive due to long-term sickness, which did see the UK fall from having the biggest employment rate fall in the G7 since 2020. So thinking about that international comparison, this hasn't necessarily been the case in all other countries in the G7. We've definitely seen a rise in ill health in the population. We've seen lengthier NHS waiting lists, some impacts from the pandemic. So one in four people say that they have a work-limiting disability, and only one in two working age people with a work-limiting disability is actually in work. And we've been seeing those long-term health conditions and work-limiting disabilities sort of rising over time for people who are both in work, who are then falling out, and for those who are out of work and trying to get in.
Torsten.
So I think on the ill health side, it's worth kind of getting to some kind of concrete things that are actually going on. So if we look at what kind of conditions we're seeing more of, and remember this rise, I think some people will listen to this topic and think it's obvious, it's just long COVID, it's just the backwash from the pandemic. So it's worth just being really clear that the rise in ill health in Britain predates COVID, before any of us had heard of COVID-19. It's happening during the 2010s. Life expectancy also stalls during the 2010s as well. So we're getting sicker before the pandemic. In terms of what conditions we're talking about, I think it's worth thinking about, yes, everything that gets a lot of discussion around mental health, that's a really big deal, particularly amongst younger people, but it's also about chronic pain and it's about diabetes amongst some older groups too. So those are the kind of concrete things we're seeing more of.
And let's be clear, we know that those are the sorts of things that people are essentially getting written off work for.
They're either getting written off or they may be choosing to exit because their current job they find hard to reconcile with their health condition. Or if they're young, they probably found it hard to get into work in the first place.
Tony Wilson, I'd be interested in your thoughts on this and also your thoughts about whether, as seemed to be suggested by the Prime Minister this week, the system incentivises people trying to be classified as sick.
So I think it's very hard to stand up an argument that we're incentivising people to take time off work sick or indeed to claim sickness benefits. I think if we're looking at the growth in economic inactivity due to long-term health, you could almost entirely explain that by a growth in the number of people who are already out of work, who were already out of work either, you know, since 2020, but often, as Torsten said, since before 2020. And that group getting bigger and more people in that group reporting that they're off work due to ill health. So it's people spending longer out of work and fewer people returning to work, which is driving this more than any increase in exits from work. Although it is worth saying more people did leave work inevitably during the pandemic itself, you know, during those lockdowns. But many of those people left for other reasons and have since ended up off work for extended periods, often due to long-term ill health. Well, we've got a few things. One is the Prime Minister's point about footnotes, I think, was just fundamentally misplaced and misguided. You know, the UK has amongst the lowest sickness absence rates in the world. You know, presenteeism is the UK's disease, not absenteeism. And the reason why people come to work when they're poorly is, among other things, because our statutory protections are so poor. Statutory sick pay is low. It's not paid for your first few days at work. Employment rights aren't very well enforced. There's all sorts of reasons why people, if you like, aren't taking enough time off. And since the pandemic, actually, people have been a bit more likely to call in sick. And I think that's probably, well, that is undoubtedly a good thing if you're staying at home when you're not well. Where we do have an issue, though, is, you know, there has been a really significant increase in the number of people applying for and also getting an element of universal credit, which is paid when you have a long-term health condition, and which also means you're then exempted from having to attend job centres. And there's been some speculation, some analysis, which suggests that that could be linked to the strictness of the benefit system for unemployed people. So in other words, you know, because people are being sanctioned to such a degree and there are so many requirements on people when they're unemployed, they're instead kind of choosing to or ending up on this health bit of the benefit where they get more benefit and are further from support. We don't really know if that's the case or not. But in as far as there is a link, you know, the most likely explanation for this is simply that people who have long-term health conditions aren't able to stay in that unemployed group because of the severity of the reporting requirements, the need to attend regularly job centres, the need to demonstrate what you've been doing. And this isn't because people weren't sick in the first place. It's because sick people are being pushed further from support because of those changes in the benefit system, which have been, you know, been in place actually since before the pandemic. And I think the solution to that actually is to get better at supporting people out of work. It's not to blame or point fingers at people who are on benefit for not trying hard enough. And I think that ends up being incredibly counterproductive, actually.
We'll come on to solutions in a little bit, but I hear two things in what Tony is saying. And one is that actually, yes, there does exist an incentive to try and be claimed as sick over being other things, because you will get a bit money and you'll get treated a bit better. The second thing I hear him saying is that if employers were better and there were better conditions for people who were actually sick, they'd be more likely to stay in work. Now, do you agree with those?
Yeah, those are both right, and they're both important. On the first, yeah, the distinction is not between you're almost never in the UK better off being out of work than in work. The system, it's not that the system's generous, but even now, after our big increases in disability benefit spending, we're spending far less than most other countries because our system isn't very generous. The distinction is within the benefit system. And what the government has done, I think, semi-accidentally over the last 7 or 8 years is to make a very binary system. So you're either on a very mean system where you are assumed to be completely able to work with quite stringent conditionality and a very low level of benefit. Remember, a single adult in the UK is living on £85 a week unemployment benefit. What's the level of destitution in the UK? £95 a week. So the system is very hard to live on if you are sick but only claiming basic unemployment benefits and you haven't got kids or other extra cost support. And then, yes, you will see £400 extra a month if you're able to prove that you're too sick to work. But creating a system where you're destitute unless you can prove that you're too sick to work is a very bad system.
Well, it's a very big incentive to try and prove you're sick. I mean, I would.
Yeah, I mean, for lots of people, they will. But I mean, the other thing to remember is we've just been through a huge cost of living crisis where the danger of destitution for lots of people has gone up very significantly. So the context also matters, as well as the benefit system choices we've made.
I think we probably should move on from just the ill health question and look at some of the other groups that make up the economically inactive. We made a programme last year about getting the over 50s back into work, and Torsten, you were on it. Is early retirement still a problem, or was it a kind of post-COVID blip? You know, those people who just kind of thought, oh, there is a different way of living a life.
We should completely chillax on the early retirements, as I think I hope I said to on your programme when it aired. Because basically, yes, there was a one-off cohort effect from people that maybe were marginal retirees and COVID came along and they thought, right, well, that'll do. Now mainly better off early retirees. And that effect has not continued. So future cohorts coming through into their late 50s and early 60s have not continued retiring at earlier rates. So we should definitely chillax about early retirement as a big driver of what is going on. As I say, it's really the big stories since your last programme are that issue has gone away. You've got remaining the ill health issue, and then students have become an ever bigger issue.
Sam, let's take up students at this point. I got confused trying to think about this one, because on one level I thought, well, it's not a really big problem because students will eventually go into the labour force. And then I thought, well, actually, that's not quite the right way of looking at it, because it still takes a number of people out of the labour force at any given time. So it does actually diminish what is available.
Yeah.
How do we account for the rise in student numbers, firstly?
So there has been a rise. Students account for 1 in 4 economically inactive people within the numbers. That's up 62% in the last 30 years. Quite a lot of that is because young people have stayed in education for longer. And since the pandemic, actually, student numbers have risen further, 5.9%. And I chair a group called the Youth Employment Group, where we were ruminating on this in the pandemic, that young people were actually sheltering in education from the impact of the pandemic on the workforce. So we have seen that rise in students within the economic inactivity sort of group that we talk about.
But why didn't people just go back after the pandemic had finished?
There was, you know, people staying in education is not a bad thing. It is a good thing for people to be further educated and maybe go into higher sort of rate jobs. But it was possibly what was, you know, you can look at the data and make some assumptions that maybe it was a safer haven than moving into the workforce at a time of quite a lot of disruption.
Torsten, can I ask you a question which may seem generationally naive? But back in the day, you could both be a student and be in the labour force.
Yeah, absolutely. So just to build on exactly what Tony and Sam have said, so there's two other little things going on, and then I'll come to your generational challenges. So one is there's more 18-year-olds, so we just happen to have a bit of a demographic bulge coming through.
Which will end.
Which will at some point end, and we just, well, but it'll take a while. But yeah, so we should be expecting inactivity for student reasons to be up anyway, just because of demographics. And then foreign students are in these numbers, remember. And we've had large increase in foreign student numbers, and that is also pushing up the number of people who are inactive, economically inactive, because they are students.
I'm sorry, Justin, are you saying we count foreign students as being domestically, economically inactive?
I'm sure you would want us to, David. They're in the UK, they'll be answering the surveys. Anyway, let's get to your generationally charged question. So I agree with this, although everything I'm going to say is going to make me sound like an old fogey, so I'm going to see myself allying with you on this one. So there is definitely a trend, and this is the opposite of what I think people think is happening, but there is a trend away from people studying and working at the same time. And that is actually true at school. Like when I was a lad and the fields were green, you know, I was working in pubs and cafes while I was doing my GCSEs and A-levels. That is a lot less likely to happen these days, which, by the way, is the reason why, even though we've had near record employment levels in the last decade, we've actually seen also a record number of people who have never worked. People have never done a job. And that is because people can actually get to university and through university having never done a job these days. So I always say this to whenever I'm doing a kind of group of employers. I gently remind them that it is all of our corporate social responsibility to employ some of the youth sometimes. And then when I'm with some parents, I also remind them that they should be telling their kids to get a bloody job.
Well, I have a feeling this may be in with the structure of student loans and so on, which weren't, and tuition fees, which weren't borrowed back in those days. One final question, Tony, about the whys. I think you touched on earlier that there were groups who were actually more economically active than before. And I think you said that women in a particular age category were available for work in a way that they haven't been.
Well, yeah, there's been a general trend towards more women in work over the last 30 years. It's been a really, really important part of a real strength in the UK and in many developed economies, an important part in the jobs boom we've seen. And that has continued through the pandemic. And in particular, we've seen growth in the number of women aged in their 30s and 40s are in work, and far fewer people outside the labour market because they're looking after their family, bringing up children typically. And the number of people outside the labour market, outside the labour force for those caring reasons, has pretty much halved over the last 20 or 30 years. You know, the reasons for that, we're having smaller families, having families later, and we're better able to combine work and study. But that has offset to some extent, but it hasn't fully offset this growth in economic inactivity for other reasons. But it's definitely a positive that we can continue to, that's continued to happen over the last few years.
Well, let's talk about how one might do that, what the solutions to these sets of problems might be. Sam, in the first instance, let's talk about the problem of people who are inactive due to ill health. What are the main solutions you would like to see us try to improve this situation?
So there are a number of solutions from a number of actors, both government, employers, when we say government, we sort of mean local, regional and national government. What the government could set as a target to sort of bring all of this work together and actually aim for something is to look at having an 80% employment rate up from 74.5 at the moment in the next decade. The reason being that would boost our economy by 23 billion a year. It would save the taxpayer 8 billion a year, and it would also increase the incomes of households by an average of £830 a year. Now, that's the overarching vision that we should be aiming for. But of course, there's a lot of activity that would be needed to drive that. On behalf of employers, we need to think about their recruitment practices, flexible working, the support for their workforce, both keeping them in work and bringing more people, diversity in. There's a big issue here as well around the current workforce and those who need to change jobs to meet demand. So more support for career changers who may need to change sectors, and also thinking about the role, as Tony said, about sort of regional government and local government. I flagged earlier that, you know, this is a localised issues and it's very much in the remit of bringing together local services, skills, employment, health. We know a lot of what works, and we need to be seeing that be put into practice and some of the funding put there so that individuals can get the support they need to move into work.
OK. Tony, what about you?
So I think we need action in a few areas. Firstly, I think we need to improve access to employment support and employment services. So we don't really have a public employment service at the moment. We've got really a kind of claimant conditionality and monitoring service. Most of the work of Job Centre Plus is focused on monitoring the claims of unemployed people. There's then also work they do, good work they do around supporting wider groups. But I think that needs to be the focus going forwards, is improving access to employment services, open access to employment services, and trying to deliver that closer to the services people already use and deliver it in ways that they would want through people that they trust. And so I think that means, you know, a broader access to employment support and being able to deliver that in health settings, community settings, and through other local services as well. But alongside that, I think we need to invest more in more specialist employment support, and we'll need to deliver that locally as well as nationally. I think one of the things that's got missed in some of this debate recently is that while the government have been talking about clamping down on fit notes and access to benefits, we'll actually be ending our only national employment programme for people with long-term health conditions and disabled people, the Work and Health programme. That'll be ending in September. So for the first time in a generation, we won't actually have any national employment support for disabled people and for people with long-term conditions. So we need to rectify that quickly, but I think that means, you know, greater devolution and localisation of services, so we can deliver that alongside health, employment, skills and other local services. And actually many areas, Greater Manchester, the West Midlands, Liverpool City region, in the northeast of England and so on, many local areas are getting on and doing this, but they need the powers and the funding to do it.
Torsten, it occurred to me while we were talking that one of the ways in which you could try and deal with part of this problem at any rate is simply to reduce the discrepancy between being unemployed in financial terms and being sick.
Yeah, so it would definitely be a better idea to have a benefit system that doesn't have two things. One, a very binary distinction between people who are either perfectly capable of doing all work and having the same requirements for a number of hours, not doing part-time work, and then people who are too sick to work full stop. So we should definitely do that. That was the system before 2017. We should never have moved away from it. And then secondly, over the longer term, the fact that the out-of-work but well enough to work benefit system is so poor, particularly for some single people, it will need addressing and is providing a big incentive. But we are going to have to look at other things. We do need to deal with the fact that as a population, we're getting sicker. We need those type 2 diabetes numbers to come down. That is to do with public health. We need to have a system that doesn't have record levels of NHS waiting lists. So there's no way around dealing with the other societal benefits. We can't put all the pressure to solve this within the benefit system, but we should definitely look there.
Torsten Bell there with Sam Avanzo-Windett and Tony Wilson. My conclusion is, this is complicated, but one thing I did pick up is that we have some perverse incentives in the system that make claiming to be sick really the sensible thing to do. We'll be back at the same time next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Sally Abrahams and Kirstine Knight. The editor was Richard Varden and the programme was mixed by James Beard. And just before we go, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to The Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, including the one about whether the Rwanda plan will work, the one about the future of the state pension and the one about the crisis in dentistry.
I'm Kavita Puri, and in 3 Million from BBC Radio 4, I hear extraordinary eyewitness accounts that tell the story, for the first time, of the Bengal famine which happened in British India in the middle of the Second World War. At least 3 million people died. It's one of the largest losses of civilian life on the Allied side, and there isn't a museum, a memorial, or even a plaque to those who died. How can the memory of 3 million people just disappear? 80 years on, I track down first-hand accounts and make new discoveries and hear remarkable stories and explore why remembrance is so complicated in Britain, India and Bangladesh. Listen to 3 million on BBC Sounds.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So, if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.